This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Something in the Water. This is the author, Catherine Stedman. Chapter 1. Saturday, October the 1st. The Grave. Have you ever wondered how long it takes to dig a grave? Wonder no longer. It takes an age. However long you think it takes, double that. I'm sure you've seen in the movies, the hero, gun to his head perhaps, as he sweats and grunts his way deeper and deeper into the earth until he's standing 6 feet down in his own grave. Or the two hapless crooks who argue and quip in the hilarious madcap chaos as they shovel frantically, dirt flying skywards with cartoonish ease. It's not like that. It's hard. Nothing about it is easy. The ground is solid and heavy. And slow. It's so damn hard. And it's boring. And long. And it has to be done. The stress, the adrenaline, the desperate animal need to do it sustains you for about 20 minutes. Then you crash. Your muscles yawn against the bones in your arms and legs. Skin to bone, bone to skin. Your heart aches from the aftermath of adrenal shock. Your blood sugar drops, you hit the wall. A full body hit. But you know with crystal clarity that high or low, exhausted or not, that hole is getting dug. And then you kick into another gear. It's that halfway point in the marathon, when the novelty's worn off and you've just got to finish the joyless bloody thing. You've invested. You're all in. You've told all your friends you'd do it. You made them pledge donations to some charity or other. One you have only a vague passing connection to. They guiltily promise more money than they really wanted to give, feeling obligated because of some bike ride or other they might have done at university, the details of which they bore you with every time they get drunk. I'm still talking about the marathon, stick with me. And then you went out, every evening, on your own, shins throbbing, headphones in, building up miles, for this. So you can fight yourself. Fight with your body. Right there, in that moment, in that stark moment, and see who wins. And nobody but you is watching. And nobody but you really cares. It's just you and yourself, trying to survive. That is what digging a grave feels like. Like the music has stopped, but you can't stop dancing. Because if you stop dancing, you die. So you keep digging. You do it. Because the alternative is far worse than digging a never-ending, god-awful hole in the hard, compacted soil with a shovel you found in some old man's shed. As you dig, you see colours drift across your eyes. Phosphenes, caused by the metabolic stimulation of neurons in the visual cortex due to low oxygenation and low glucose. Your ears roar with blood. Low blood pressure caused by dehydration and overexertion. But your thoughts... Your thoughts skim across the still pool of your consciousness, only occasionally glancing the surface, gone before you can grasp them. Your mind is completely blank. The central nervous system treats this overexertion as a fight-or-flight situation. Exercise-induced neurogenesis, along with that ever-popular sports mag favorite, exercise-induced endorphin release, acts to both inhibit your brain and protect it from the sustained pain and stress of what you're doing. Exhaustion is a fantastic emotional leveler, running or digging. Around the 45-minute mark, I decide 6 feet is an unrealistic depth for this grave. I will not manage to dig down to 6 feet. I'm 5'6". How would I even climb out? I would literally have dug myself into a hole. According to a 2014 YouGov survey, 5'6" is the ideal height for a British woman. Apparently that's the height that the average British man would prefer his partner to be. So, lucky me. Lucky Mark. God, I wish Mark were here. So if I'm not digging 6 feet under, how far under? How deep is deep enough? Bodies tend to get found because of poor burial. I don't want that to happen. I really don't. That would definitely not be the outcome I'm after. A poor burial, like a poor anything else really, comes down to three things. 1. Lack of time. 2. Lack of initiative. 3. Lack of care. In terms of time, I have 3 to 6 hours to do this. 3 hours is my conservative estimate. 6 hours is the daylight I have left. I have time. I believe I have initiative. 2 brains are better than 1. I hope. I just need to work through this step by step. And 3, care. God, do I care. I care. More than I've ever cared in my entire life. 3 feet is the minimum depth recommended by the ICCM, Institute of Cemetery and Crematorium Management. I know this because I Googled it. I Googled it before I started digging. See? Initiative. Care. I squatted down next to the body, wet leaves and mud multi underfoot, and I Googled how to bury a body. I Googled this on the body's burner phone. So if they do find the body, they won't find the body. And manage to retrieve the data, they won't retrieve the data. Then this search history is going to make fantastic reading. 2 full hours in, I stop digging. The hole is just over 3 feet deep. I don't have a tape measure, but I remember that 3 feet is around crotch height. The height of the highest jump I managed on a horse riding vacation I took before I left for university 12 years ago. An 18th birthday present. Weird what sticks in the memory, isn't it? Here I am, waist deep in a grave, remembering a gymkhana. I got second prize, by the way. I was very happy with it. Anyway, I've dug approximately 3 feet deep, 2 feet wide, 6 feet long. Yes, that took 2 hours. To reiterate, digging a grave is very hard. Just to put this into perspective for you, this hole, my 2 hour hole, is 3 foot by 2 foot by 6 foot, which is 36 cubic feet of soil, which is 1 cubic meter of soil, which is 1.5 tons of soil, and that is the weight of a hatchback car, or a fully grown beluga whale, or the average hippopotamus. I've moved the equivalent of that up and slightly to the left of where it was before. And this grave is only 3 feet deep. I look across the mud at the mound and slowly hoist myself out, forearms trembling under my own weight. The body lies across from me under a torn tarpaulin, its brilliant cobalt a slash of color against the brown forest floor. I'd found it abandoned, hanging like a veil from a branch, back towards the lay-by, in quiet communion with an abandoned fridge. The fridge's small freezer box door creaking calmly in the breeze. Dumped. There's something so sad about abandoned objects, isn't there? Desolate. But kind of beautiful. I suppose in a sense I've come to abandon a body. The fridge has been there a while. I know this because I saw it from the car window as we drove past here 3 months ago. And nobody's come for it yet. We were on our way back to London from Norfolk, Mark and I, after celebrating our anniversary. And here the fridge still is months later. Odd to think so much has happened. To me. To us. In that time, but nothing has changed here. As if this spot were adrift from time. A holding area. It has that feel. Perhaps no one's been here since the fridge owner was here, and God knows how long ago that might have been. The fridge looks distinctly 70s. You know, in that bricky way. Bricky, Kubricky. A monolith in a damp English wood. Obsolete. 3 months it's been here at least, and no collection, no men from the dump. No one comes here, that's clear. Except us. No council workers, no disgruntled locals to write letters to the council. No early morning dog walkers to stumble across my quarry. It's the safest place I could think of. So here we are. It will take a while for it all to settle. The soil. But I think the fridge and I have enough time. I look it over. The crumpled tarp mound. Underneath lie flesh, skin, bone, teeth. 3.5 hours dead. I wonder if he's still warm. My husband. Warm to the touch. I Google it. Either way, I don't want the shock. Okay, the arms and legs should be cold to the touch, but the main body will still be warm. Okay, then. I take a long, full exhalation. Okay, here we go. I stop. Wait. I don't know why, but I clear his Burnaphone search history. It's pointless, I know. The phone's untraceable, and after a couple of hours in the damp October ground, it won't work anyway. But then maybe it will. I place the burner back in his coat pocket, and I slip his personal iPhone out of his chest pocket. It's on airplane mode. I look through the photo library. Us. Tears well, and then streak in two hot dribbles down my face. I fully remove the tarp, exposing everything it conceals. I wipe the phone for prints, return it to its warm chest pocket, and brace my knees to drag. I'm not a bad person. Or maybe I am. Maybe you should decide. But I should definitely explain. And to explain, I need to go back. Back to that anniversary morning, 3 months ago. Chapter 2, Friday, July the 8th, anniversary morning. We woke up before sunrise this morning, Mark and I. It's our anniversary morning, the anniversary of the first day we met. We've been staying in a boutique pub hotel on the Norfolk coast. Mark found it in the Financial Times' How to Spend It supplement. He has a subscription, but the supplements are the only bits he ever has time to read. The FT was right, though. This is the cozy country bolt hole of your dreams. And I'm glad this is how we're spending it. Of course, it's not my it we're spending, really. But I suppose it will be soon. The hotel is a perfect country nest of fresh seafood, cold beer, and cashmere throws. Chelsea on Sea, the guidebooks call it. We spent the past 3 days walking until our muscles were loose and heavy, our cheeks flushed from English sunshine and windburn, hair smelling of forest and salty sea. Walking and then fucking, bathing and eating. Heaven. The hotel had originally been built in 1651 as a coaching inn for customs officials making that bumpy trip to London, and had since boasted famous Norfolkian and Battle of Trafalgar winner Vice Admiral Horatio Lord Nelson as a regular patron. He stayed in room 5, the one next to us, and came here to collect his dispatches every Saturday of his 5-year unemployment, apparently. Interesting that Lord Nelson had stretches of unemployment. I suppose I always thought if you were in the Navy, then you were just in the Navy. But there you go. It happens to the best of us. Anyway, throughout the years, livestock auctions, assizes, and all the fun of the Jane Austen Fair have been hosted here in the hotel. The coffee table book in our room had gleefully informed us that the preliminary hearings for the infamous Burnham murderers trial had been held in what was now the private dining room downstairs. Infamous is questionable. I certainly had never heard of them. So I read up. The story began in 1835, with the wife of a shoemaker violently retching up her stomach at the family dinner table as her husband watched. Mrs. Taylor, the retcher, had been poisoned with arsenic. The flour in the larder had been laced with stuff, and arsenic traces were later found in her stomach lining at autopsy. An inquest into the poisoning found that Mr. Taylor had been having an affair with their neighbour, a Mrs. Fanny Billing. And Fanny Billing had recently purchased 3 pennyworth of arsenic from a local druggist. That arsenic had made its way into the Taylor's flour bag, and consequently into the dumplings that ended the life of Mrs. Taylor. I guess Mr. Taylor was abstaining that evening. Perhaps Mr. Taylor was on a no-carbs diet. Further information supplied by another neighbour at the inquest stated that a Mrs. Catherine Frary had had access to the Taylor's home that day and had been heard telling Fanny before her questioning, "Hold your own and they can't hurt us." Upon further investigation, it was found that Catherine's husband and her child had also both died very suddenly the previous fortnight. Foul play was suspected. Catherine's husband's and child's stomachs were shipped to Norwich, where analysis confirmed that they too contained arsenic. A witness at the Taylor's house attested that he had seen Catherine attending to the sick Mrs. Taylor post-retching, and he had seen her add a white powder on the tip of a knife from a paper packet into Mrs. Taylor's gruel, poisoning her a second time, this time fatally. The two women had also poisoned Catherine's sister-in-law the week before. Catherine and Fanny were hung in Norwich for the multiple murders of their husbands, as well as Mrs. Taylor, Catherine's child, and Catherine's sister-in-law. According to the Niles Weekly Register of October the 17th, 1835, the pair were launched into eternity amidst an immense concourse of spectators, 20,000 or 30,000, above one half of whom were women. Launched into eternity. Nice shipping reference. Odd to put the Burnham murderers in the hotel information booklet, especially considering the nature of weekend getaways. The alarm wakes us at 4:30 in the morning from our warm bundle of goose down and Egyptian cotton. We dress in silence, our clothes laid out the night before, thin cotton t-shirts, walking boots, jeans, and woolen sweaters for before the sun rises. I make us some coffee using the little machine in the room while Mark fixes his hair in the bathroom. Mark's not a vain man by any standard, but like most men in their 30s, his getting ready seems to be mainly hair-based. I like his dithering, though. A little chink in his perfection. I like that I can be ready quicker. We drink our coffee fully clothed on top of the duvet, windows open, his arm around me, silent. We'll have enough time to jump in the car and get to the beach for the break of dawn. Sunrise is listed as 5:05 on the daily information card by the bed. We drive in relative silence to Holcombe Beach, breathing and thinking. We're together, but alone with our thoughts and each other, trying to hang on to the thick sleepiness that hasn't quite faded away yet. There's an innate sense of ritual to it all. We have that sometimes. Things just happen that way for us. A little bit of magic creeps into our lives and we nurture it like a succulent. We've done all this before, it's one of our things. Anniversary morning. As we pull into park, I wonder if we'll still celebrate this day after we're married, 2 months from now. Or maybe that will be our new day. We get out to thick quiet at Holcombe Hall, silence pierced intermittently by bursts of rich birdsong. A herd of deer in the adjoining field look up as we slam the car doors and freeze. We hold their gaze, all momentarily caught in stasis, until their attention drops back down to the grass. We are one of the first cars of the day in the clay gravel car park. It will get much busier later, it always does, with dogs and families, horse boxes and riders, family clans eking out the last of the good weather. Apparently this heat won't last. But then they say that every year, don't they? No one is in sight yet as we make our way along the gravel tracks, down to the great desert stretch of Holcombe Beach. 4 miles of golden white sand skirted by pine forests. The North Sea wind bends patches of wild grasses and whips sand up into the air along the ridgebacks of towering dunes. Miles of freshly blown sand and sea and not a soul in sight. Unearthly in the pre-dawn light. A fresh, barren landscape. It always feels like a clean start. Like the new year. Mark takes my hand, and we walk out towards the shore. At the water's edge, we squeeze off our boots and slip into the icy North Sea, jeans pushed up to our knees. His smile, his eyes, his hot hand tightly gripping mine, the sharp, taut feeling of the icy water on my feet bursting into fluid white heat up my legs, burning cold. We timed it exactly right. The sky starts to lighten. We laugh. Mark counts down to 5:05 on his wristwatch, and we look patiently east across the water. The entire sky lightens to twilight before the sun crests the silver water. Yellow streaks the horizon and ombers out to peaches and pinks as it hits the lowest clouds. And beyond, the whole sky blazes blue. Azure blue. Ha! It's so beautiful. So beautiful, I feel nauseous. When we can't stand the cold anymore, I wade back to shore, bending to clean the sand off my feet in the shallows before I put my boots back on. My engagement ring catches the full glare of the sun, refracting through the crystal water. The early morning mist is gone, the air full of moisture, salty and crisp. So bright, so clear. The sky in high definition blue, the best day of the year, always. So much hope, every year. Mark asked me to marry him last October, after his 35th birthday. Although we'd been together for years, it had still been a surprise somehow. I sometimes wonder if things pass me by more than other people. Maybe I don't pay enough attention. Or maybe I'm just not that good at picking stuff up. Things often surprise me. I'm always surprised to find out from Mark that so-and-so didn't like so-and-so, or somebody was attracted to me or had some other strong reaction. I never notice. I suppose that's probably for the best. What you don't know can't hurt you. Mark notices things. He's very good with people. People light up when they see him coming. They love him. People often ask me, on the rare occasions that we do anything separately, "Isn't Mark coming?" with a tone of bemused disappointment. I don't take it personally because that's how I feel too. Mark makes all situations better. He listens. Really listens. He holds eye contact, not aggressively, but in a way that reassures people. His look says, "I'm here." And that's enough for me. He's interested in people. Mark's look has no angle. He's just there, with you. We sit high on a dune, looking out across the wide, flat expanse of sky and sea. It's windier up here. The air howls in our ears. I'm glad of the thick sweaters. The coarse Irish wool gives off the scent of animal as it warms. The conversation turns to the future. Our plans. We've always made plans on this day. Like resolutions, I suppose. Mid-year resolutions. I've always enjoyed planning ahead, since I was a child. I like to plan. I like to take stock. Mark had never really done resolutions before we met, but he took to it instantly. It suited him, the progressive, futurist nature of it. My mid-year resolutions aren't out of the ordinary. The usual. Read more, watch TV less, work smarter, spend more time with loved ones, eat better, drink less, be happy. And then Mark says he wants to focus on work more. Mark works in banking. I know, yes, boo, hiss. But all I can say is, he's not an arsehole. You'll have to trust me on that. He's definitely no Eton drinking club polo team alumnus. He's a Yorkshire lad made good. Granted, his dad wasn't exactly a coal miner or anything. Mr. Roberts, now retired, had been a pensions advisor for Prudential in East Riding. Mark moved forward fast in the city, passed his regulation exams, became a trader, specialised in sovereigns, got poached, got promoted, and then it happened. The financial crash. The bottom fell out of the financial industry. Everyone who understood was terrified from the first day. They could see it all spooling out ahead of them. Technically, Mark was fine. His job was safe. If anything, it was safer than before because he specialized in the exact thing that everyone needed help with after the crash. Sovereign debt. But bonuses plummeted for everyone. Which was fine, we weren't exactly on the breadline. But a lot of his friends got laid off, which was terrifying. It scared me at the time, watching grown adults failing. They had kids in school and mortgages they couldn't afford anymore. The wives hadn't worked since pregnancy. No one had a backup plan. That year was the year that people came to dinner and cried. They'd leave our house apologizing, smiling bravely, and promising to see us once they'd moved back to their hometowns and got their lives back on track. We never heard from a lot of them again. We'd hear that they'd moved back in with their parents in Berkshire or moved to work in Australia or divorced. Mark switched banks. All his colleagues had been let go where he was, and he'd been left doing five people's jobs, so he took a chance and went somewhere else. The new bank, I don't like. It's not quite right. The men there managed to be fat and yet sinewy at the same time. They're out of shape, and they smoke, which I didn't used to mind at all, but now it has that air of nervous desperation that worries me. It smells of bile and broken dreams. Mark's colleagues sometimes come out with us for drinks and sneer and bitch about their wives and kids as if I weren't there. As if were it not for those women, they'd be on some beach somewhere. Mark isn't like them. He looks after himself. He runs, he swims, he plays tennis. He keeps himself healthy. And now he sits in a room for 11 hours a day with these men. I know he's strong-minded, but I can see it wearing him down. And now, on this day of all days, on our anniversary, he announces he wants to focus on work more. Focus means I'll see him less. He already works too hard. He gets up at 6 a.m. every weekday, leaves the house at 6:30, has lunch at his desk, and then gets home to me totally exhausted at 7:30 at night. We have dinner and talk, maybe watch a film, and he's in bed with the lights out at 10 to do it all again. That's when I want to change, though, he says. I've been working there for a year now. When I moved there, they promised I'd only be in this position initially, until we restructured the department, but they won't let me do that. They won't let me restructure, so I'm not actually doing what they hired me to do. He sighs, rubs his hand up and down his face, which is fine. But I need to have a proper conversation with Lawrence. We need to talk about my end-of-year bonus, or changing the team, because some of these jokers have no idea what they're doing. He pauses, then looks at me. I'm serious, Erin. I wasn't going to tell you this, but after that deal went through on Monday, Hector rang me, crying. Why was he crying? I asked, surprised. Hector's worked alongside Mark for years now. When Mark left the other bank when everything was going wrong, Mark promised Hector he'd find him a position if he moved. And he kept his promise. Mark made Hector part of his deal when he moved. They came as a pair or not at all. You know, we were waiting for the figures the other day to sign off on the deal. He looks at me searchingly. Yeah, you took the call in the car park, I say, nodding him on. He'd slipped out of our pub lunch yesterday and spent an hour pacing the gravel while his food went cold. I'd read my book. I'm self-employed, so I know the phone wonder well. Yeah, he told me he'd got the figures. The guys in the trading desk had been really hard to even get in the office over the holidays, and they'd made it pretty difficult for him. They've called a meeting once we're back to discuss overtime hours and fair practice. It's ridiculous. Anyway, Hector spoke to New York, tried to explain that no one was in and why the figures were late, and they went fucking mental. Andrew, you remember Andrew in New York, right? I told you about that guy I heard you swearing at through the phone at Brittany's wedding. I interrupt. He snorts and smiles. Yeah. Andrew. He's highly strung. But anyway, so Andrew screams at Hector on the phone, and Hector freaks out and just prices the deal and hits send. Goes to bed. Wakes up to hundreds of missed calls and emails. Turns out they put an extra zero in the figures. Greg and the other guys on the desk put it in to slow down the deal. They thought Hector would look it over before sending and get them to redo it next week once we were all back in the office. But Hector didn't check it. He signed off on it and sent it. And that is a legally binding contract. Oh my God, Mark. Can't they just say it was an error? Not really, honey. So Hector rings me and he's trying to explain that he just assumed it would be right and he always, always, usually checks. But Andrew said send it and he just starts crying. Erin, I feel like I'm surrounded by absolute... Mark stops himself and shakes his head ruefully. So, I'm going to put the feelers out for somewhere else. I'm 100% happy to take a bonus drop or a salary cut. The market's not going back to the way it was anyway. Who are we kidding? I just don't need this stress anymore. I want my life back. I want you and babies and our evenings again. I like the sound of that. Very much. I hug him, bury my head in his shoulder. I want that too. Good. He kisses my hair lightly. I'll find a good place, Hand in my notice after this Hector stuff settles. Take my garden leave for the wedding and honeymoon stretch and start back, hopefully, around November, just in time for Christmas. He's done garden leave before. Everyone who works in the financial sector has to take a mandatory leave between jobs. It's supposed to stop insider trading, but it's essentially a 2-month paid vacation. This does sound like a pretty good plan. Good for him. But I could definitely take a few weeks away from my work, too. We could make a thing of it. Get some serious honeymooning done. I'm working on my first feature-length documentary right now, but I'll have completed the first stage of filming by the wedding, and then I should have a good 3 to 4 week gap before I start on the second stage. That 3 to 4 weeks could definitely work in our favor. A warm feeling spreads through my chest. This is good. This will be better for us. Where should we go? He asks. Honeymoon. This is the first time we've really talked about it. It's 2 months away now, the wedding. We've covered all of that, but this we've left fresh, untouched, like an unopened gift. But I guess now is as good a time as any to broach the subject. I'm excited by the possibility of it all, having him all to myself for weeks. Let's go crazy. It might be the last time we have the time or money. I throw it out there. Yes, he shouts, matching my energy. 2 weeks? No, 3 weeks, I offer. I squint, thinking through the filming schedule and interviews I have to do. I can manage 3. Now we're talking Caribbean, Maldives, Bora Bora, he asks. Bora Bora? That sounds perfect. I have no idea where it is, but it sounds glorious. Fuck it. First class? Can we do first class? He grins at me. We can do first class. I'll book it. Great. I've never flown first class before. And then I say something I'll probably live to regret. I'm going to go scuba diving with you. When we go. I'll try it again. Then we can go down together. I say it because it seems like all I can give Mark to show him how much I love him. Like a cat with a dead mouse in its mouth. Whether he wants it or not, I drop it at his feet. Seriously? He stares at me, concerned. The sunlight creasing his eyes. The breeze ruffling his dark hair. He wasn't expecting that. Mark's a qualified diver. He's been trying to get me to go with him on every trip we've ever been on together. But I've always chickened out. I had a bad experience once, before we met. I panicked. Nothing serious, but the whole idea really scares the shit out of me. I don't like the idea of feeling trapped. The thought of the pressure and the slow underwater ascents fills me with dread. But I want to do this thing for him. New life together? New challenges. I grin. Yes, definitely. I can do it. How hard can it be? Kids do it. I'll be fine. He looks at me. I fucking love you, Aaron Locke, he says. Just like that. I fucking love you too, Mark Roberts. He leans in, tilts my head and kisses me. Are you real? He asks, fixing my gaze. We've played this game before. Except it's not really a game at all. Or is it? A mind game, perhaps. What he's actually asking is this real? It's so good it must be a trick. A mistake. I must be lying. Am I lying? I give it a second. I let the muscles in my face fall as he studies me. I let my pupils contract like the universe imploding. And calmly reply, no. No, I'm not real. It's scary. I've only done it a few times. Absented myself from my own face. Made myself disappear. Like a phone reverting to factory settings. No, I'm not real. I say simply. My face blank and open. It has to look like I mean it. It works best when it looks real. His eyes flicker and jump across my face, searching for a hook, a crack to hang understanding on. There's nothing there. I've disappeared. I know he worries. He worries deep down that one day I'll actually just vanish. Leave. That this isn't real. That he'll wake up and everything will be the same in the house, but I won't be there. I know that fear. I see it flutter across his face at random moments, when we're out with friends, or standing on opposite sides of a busy room. I see it. That look. And then I know that he is real. I see it on his face now, and that's enough for me. I let the smile creep out of me, and his face bursts with joy. He laughs. Flushing with emotion, I laugh, and then he takes my face in his hands again and puts his lips to mine like I've won a race, like I'm back from war. Well done, me. God, I love you, Mark. He pulls me into the salt marsh reeds and we fuck, desperately, hands full of woolen sweater and wet skin. As he comes, I whisper in his ear, I'm real. Chapter 3. Monday, July the 11th. The phone call. Last year, I finally got co-funding from a prison charity to finance my first solo project. It's now coming together after years of research and planning, my very own feature-length documentary. I've managed to get all the research and pre-production done whilst taking freelance projects along the way, and I'm due to start filming the face-to-face interviews in 9 days. I've put so much of myself into this production, and I hope, more than anything, that it all comes together. There's only so far planning can take you, then you have to just wait and see what happens. It's a big year, for me, for us. The film, the wedding, everything seems to be happening all at once. But I honestly think I'm at that magical point in my life where all the plans I set in motion in my 20s are finally coming together, all in unison. As if somehow I'd deliberately orchestrated it that way, though I don't remember consciously doing that. I guess that's the way life works, isn't it? Nothing, and then everything at once. The idea for the film is simple, really. It came to me one evening when I was telling Mark about what it was like at boarding school. At night, after lights out, we girls would spend hours in the darkness talking about what we would do when we finally got home. What we would eat when we could choose our own food. We'd fantasize endlessly about those imagined meals. We'd obsess over Yorkshire puddings and gravy or cocktail sausages on sticks. We'd imagine what we would wear when we could choose our own clothes, where we would go, what we would do when we had our freedom. And then Mark said it sounded like prison. That we'd dreamt of home in the same way that prisoners dream of home. So came the idea for the documentary. Its format is simple. It will follow 3 different prisoners during and after incarceration through interviews and fly-on-the-wall coverage, 2 women and 1 man, charting their hopes and dreams about their freedom before and after release. Today I'm doing my last introductory telephone conversation with my final prisoner. Then I'll be conducting face-to-face interviews with each of the subjects in prison before they're released. So far I've spoken several times to the 2 female candidates, but it's been much harder to secure access to my male candidate. Today we finally got our hard-won phone call. Today I'm waiting for a phone call from Eddie Bishop. The Eddie Bishop. One of the last remaining East End London gangsters. 100% authentic, chop you up with a hatchet, nightclub casino, Cockney rhyming gangster. An original Richardson gang member and, more recently, the centre of the largest criminal gang in London operating south of the river. I stare down at the house phone. It's not ringing. It's supposed to be ringing. It's 1:12 and I've been waiting for an incoming call from Pentonville Prison for 13 minutes. My other subjects, Alexa's and Holly's calls, came through exactly on time. I wonder what the problem is and pray that Eddie hasn't pulled out, changed his mind. I pray the prison board hasn't changed theirs. It was hard to get approval from the prison board on anything, so I'll be conducting the face-to-face interview portions on my own, just me and a locked-off fixed-position camera. It'll be raw footage at that stage, but then that fits the content, so I'm happy. During the second stage, once my candidates are out of prison, Phil and Duncan are joining me. Phil is a cameraman I know and trust implicitly. He's got a great eye and we share a very similar aesthetic, which I know sounds a bit pretentious, but I promise it's important. And Duncan and I have worked together a couple of times before. He's fun, but More importantly, he's much better than I can afford. Duncan and Phil will both be taking a hit on the money front for this. The funding's good, but it's not great. Thankfully, they love the concept as much as I do, and they've got faith in the project. I look through the plastic wallets containing my hard-won permissions papers from the Ministry of Justice and Her Majesty's Prison Service. More than anything, I want the documentary to overcome the conventional representation of prisoners by trying to show these three people as individuals, separate from their convictions. Both Holly and Eddie have sentences between 4 and 7 years for non-fatal crimes. Alexa has a sentence of life with parole, so 14 years. But do these sentences say anything about who they are as people? Does that tell you who is more dangerous, who is a better person, who you can trust? We'll see. I pull the phone cord and all over to the sofa and sit down with it in a patch of sunlight under the window. Leafy North London sun instantly warms my shoulders and the back of my neck. Somehow the British summer is lingering. We usually only get a couple of days of proper summer, but the sunshine is still going strong. We've had 3 weeks of it already. They're saying it won't last, but it has so far. Mark's out at work and the house is silent. Only the muffled rumble of lorries and the buzz of scooters reach me from distant Stoke Newington High Street. I look out of the Georgian sash windows into our back garden. A cat wanders along the back wall, black with white paws. I've had to call in favors from everyone to get this far. Fred Davey, the director who gave me my first job, vouched for me in a letter to the Minister for Justice. I'm pretty sure Fred's 2 BAFTAs and the Oscar nomination helped my cause a damn sight better than the synopsis I wrote for the film proposal. ITV has already expressed an interest in picking up the doc after general release, and Channel 4 vouched for my work in another letter. They've already aired 2 of my shorts. My film school backed me, of course. The White Cube gave me a reference, for what that's worth, to the Ministry of Justice. So did all the production companies I freelance for, and Creative England, which has helped me so much with funding and support throughout the process so far. And then, of course, I have Eddie Bishop. He's the real coup. An absolute dream for a documentarian. This interview is why I got my funding, so this phone call is kind of a big deal. Eddie is kind of a big deal. You might not know it, but Eddie's story is British crime history. He joined the Richardson Gang at the age of 18 when the gang was at the height of its power, just before its fall in 1966. It was the year England won the World Cup, and the year it all kicked off with the craze. Eddie had an aptitude for crime. He was reliable, he was straightforward, he got things done. Whatever the job was, no muss, no fuss. He quickly became indispensable to the Richardson brothers. So much so that when the Richardsons were finally arrested that summer in 1966, Eddie Bishop was there to keep everything running smoothly, while the brothers and the rest of the gang were behind bars. Eddie allegedly rebuilt the whole syndicate in South London and ran it for 42 years until his arrest for money laundering 7 years ago. 4 decades Eddie ran South London, murdered, slashed, and extorted his way across the city, and all they could give him was 7 years for money laundering. Ring, ring. The phone pierces the silence, shrill, insistent, and all at once I'm nervous. Ring, 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 ring. I tell myself it's fine. I've done this before with other subjects. It's fine. I take a shaky breath and lift the receiver to my ear, to my mouth. Hello?
Hello, is that Erin Locke?
The voice is female, curt, mid-40s, not what I was expecting. Clearly not Eddie Bishop. Yes, this is Erin Locke.
This is Diane Ford from Pentonville Prison. I have a call from a Mr. Eddie Bishop for you. Can I connect you, Miss Locke?
Diane Ford sounds bored. She doesn't care who I am or who he is. To her, this is just another call. Yes, thank you, Diane, thanks. And she's gone. The faint click of a disconnection and a hold tone. Eddie's never given an interview. He's never said a word to anyone about any of it. Ever. I don't for a second believe that I'll be the one to crack the case wide open. And I'm not sure I'd want to. Eddie's been a professional criminal for longer than I've been alive. I don't know why on earth he's agreed to be part of my documentary, but here we are. He strikes me as the kind of man who does things for a reason, so I guess I'll figure out what that reason is soon enough. I take another shaky breath. Then the line connects.
This is Eddie.
The voice is deep, warm. A rich Cockney glottal stop of a voice. Strange to finally hear it. Hello, Mr. Bishop. It's nice to finally speak to you. This is Erin Locke. How are you doing today? A good start. Very professional. I hear him shuffle at the other end of the line, settling in.
Hello, sweetheart. Nice to hear from you. Locke, is it? Not a Roberts yet, then? When's the big day?
He asks it cheerily, off the cuff. I can hear a smile in his voice. It would be a nice thing to ask someone under any other circumstances, and I almost smile back into the phone, but something makes me stop. Because there is no way that Eddie could possibly know about my approaching wedding, or name change, or Mark, unless he's been looking into me. And he's in prison, which means that he must have had me looked into. And looking into me is a more involved process than a quick online search. I'm not on social media. I don't do Facebook. All good documentarians know what you can do with a healthy dose of social media information. So we keep off it. So in one simple sentence, Eddie Bishop has just told me that he's been having me professionally looked into. He's had me vetted. He's in charge, and he knows all about me, and Mark, and our life. I take a moment before answering. He's testing me. I don't want to make a misstep so early in the game. I gather we've both done our research, Mr. Bishop. Did you find out anything interesting? There's nothing too controversial in my past. No dancing skeletons in my closet. I know this, of course, but still feel exposed, under threat. This is his show of power, a verbal line in the sand. Eddie may have been behind bars for 7 years, but he wants me to know he's still got his hands on all the ropes. If he wasn't being so upfront about it, right now I'd be terrified.
Very reassuring, I'd say. Put my mind to rest, sweetheart. You can never be too careful.
Eddie's decided I'm safe, but he wants me to know he's watching. I move on, stand and try to unravel the phone cord, slipping into work spiel. Thank you for agreeing to take part in this. I really appreciate you agreeing, and I want you to know that I am going to handle the interviews in as unbiased and straightforward a way as I can. I'm not in the business of creating straw dogs. I'm just going to tell your story. Or rather, I'm going to let you tell your story, the way you want. I hope he knows I mean that. I'm sure he's had plenty of people try and sell him snake oil in the past.
I know, sweetheart. Why do you think I said yes to you? You're a rarity. Just don't let me down, eh?
He lets that sink in for a second before shaking off the intensity, lightening the tone.
Anyway, when's all this kick off, then?
His tone is bright, industrious. Well, our face-to-face interview is scheduled for September the 24th, which is about 2.5 months away, and then your release is sometime in early December, so we can arrange nearer the time when we'll do your post-release filming. Would you be happy with us shadowing you on release day itself? I ask. I'm in my element now. This is where all my planning is coming into its own. If we can film Eddie's actual release, fly on the wall style, that would really be something. His voice comes back, warm but clear.
I'll be honest, love. It's not ideal for me. I have a bit on that day, if you know what I mean. Maybe give me a day or two, eh? That work for you?
We're negotiating. He wants to give me something. That's definitely a good sign. Of course, we'll iron it out as we go along. You have my number, so we'll just keep in touch on those dates. Not a problem. I watch the cat outside creep back along the fence, its back hunched, its head low. Eddie clears his throat. Is there anything else about the interviews or schedule you'd like to ask about at this stage, Mr. Bishop? I ask. He laughs.
No. I think we're done for today, sweetheart. Apart from you calling me Eddie. Nice to talk to you finally, though, Aaron, after hearing so much about you.
You too, Eddie. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, and give my regards to Mark, won't you, darling? Seems like a nice fella.
It's a throwaway remark, but my breath catches in my chest. He's been looking into Mark too. My Mark. I don't know what to say. The little pause I've left grows into a silence on the line. He fills it.
So how did you two meet then?
He leaves the question hanging in the air. Shit. This isn't and shouldn't be about me. That's none of your business, Eddie. Now is it? I say it with a forced smile in my voice. The words come out smooth and confident and weirdly with a hint of sexuality. Entirely inappropriate, but somehow perfectly appropriate.
Ha. No. Quite right, sweetheart. None of my business at all.
Eddie roars with laughter. I hear it echo along the prison hallway at the other end of the line.
Very good, love. Very good.
And there we go. We're back on track. It seems to be going well. We seem to be getting on. Me and Eddie Bishop. I smile down at the phone. A genuine grin this time. I smile in my empty living room, by myself, bathed in sunlight. Chapter 4. How We Met. I met Mark in Annabelle's, a private club in Mayfair. Let's be clear. Annabelle's is not the sort of place either of us frequents. It was the first and last time I've ever been there. Not for any terrible reason. I'd had fun there. God, I met the love of my life there. But it was just pure chance that either of us were there in the first place. If you've never heard of Annabelle's before, it's a strange one. Nestled under a nondescript staircase in Berkeley Square and open for the past 5 decades, it's seen everyone from Nixon to Lady Gaga tip-tapping down its staircase. Opened by Mark Burley at the suggestion of his close friend Lord Aspinall in the 60s as a casino, more along the lines of a Connery Bond location and less of a one-armed bandit arrangement. Burley was tied up with royalty, politics, and crime, so, as you can imagine, he pulled in a pretty sexy crowd. He created a quiet little supper club slash pickup spot, run by the establishment for the establishment. That night, I wasn't a member, but I was with one. I met Caro on my first job out of the National Film and Television School. It was a TV documentary on the White Cube galleries. I'd been so excited to get it. My professor had put in a word with the producer and passed along my first short, which she'd loved. I was camera assistant to Fred Davey, one of my absolute heroes, the man who would eventually help me get my first feature documentary into production. Thankfully, we got on well. I tend to be quite good with tricky people. I turn up early and set up, bring coffee and smile, try to be invisible yet indispensable, walking that tricky line between flirty and reliable. Caro had done some talking head stuff on the documentary. She was the smartest person I'd ever met, or at least the most thoroughly educated person I'd ever met. She'd been the most recent recipient of a starred first in history from Cambridge, following in the footsteps of Simon Sharma and Alain de Botton. Not short on job offers after graduation, she'd unexpectedly taken a job running a new gallery, bankrolled by her best friend from prep school. 5 years later, that gallery had reputedly discovered the next generation of great British artists. She'd invited me out for drinks after we'd wrapped on the first day of filming, and we'd been fast friends ever since. Caro was fun. She had a habit of elliptically referring to her heritage. I'd catch glimpses of blue-stockinged, cigarette-rolling badasses through the folds of her illusions. She was exciting and glamorous, and a couple of weeks after we met, she took me to Annabelle's. The first time I saw Mark, I was on my way back from the toilets. I'd been hiding there trying to dodge a hedge fund bore who'd gotten it into his head that my sporadic nodding coupled with determined crowd searching somehow indicated interest. I had it on good information from a Spanish girl that hedge fund was still hanging around outside the ladies' room entrance with a fresh drink waiting for my return, so I took the opportunity to brush up on current affairs via my phone. I gave it 10 minutes and then made a break for it. Hedge fund was gone. gone a-wooing some other lucky lady, no doubt. I made a beeline back to the bar, spotting the back of Caro's dull golden dress through the crowd. She was speaking animatedly to someone. Then, as she twisted to the right, she revealed her talking partner. I literally broke step, my body deciding before my brain that my presence would not be needed in their interaction. Caro was gorgeous, a tall, confident Amazon of a woman, the lines of her gold lamé dress skimming every curve of her body. She was clearly not wearing underwear. She looked like a glossy magazine perfume ad, and this man was her magazine equal. He was perfect. Tall, substantial. He looked muscular without giving the impression that he worked out. Maybe he was a rower, or it could be tennis. Maybe he chopped down trees. Yes, he'd be very good at chopping trees down. I remember feeling an unnaturally strong desire to watch him do that. Short, brown, tousled hair, slept in but still just about business appropriate. He smiled broadly at something I couldn't quite hear, and Caro burst into laughter. I don't know why, but for some reason I sped up. I like to think that my body took over, a cellular need. Anyway, I pulled myself to my full height without a clue what I would say when I got there, and entirely not in control of my actions. His eyes caught mine at least 10 steps away, and he took me in, his gaze doing a dance over me that I would come to recognize and yearn for the rest of my life. His gaze, searching my face, tripping and darting from my eyes to my mouth, looking for me. I'd had time to change before we left the shoot, and I'd opted for a vintage jumpsuit in dusty pink and rose gold cage shoes. It was my Faye Dunaway network outfit, for emergency evening situations only. I looked good in it. I know this because men like hedge fund don't go for personality. Caro turns her head towards me, following the brown-haired man's look. Hey, honey, where the hell have you been? She beams at me, obviously happy at the effect we're both having. I feel a blush begin in my neck, but I shut it down. Mark, this gorgeous creature is my friend Erin. She's an artist. She makes documentaries. She's a genius. She coos, slipping her arm through mine in a surprisingly territorial way. It's nice to be wanted. Erin, this is Mark. He works in the city. He enjoys collecting modern art. Although we've ascertained he's not a fan of anything featuring Kalashnikovs or human fingernails, but aside from that, he has an open mind. Right? He smiles and extends a hand. Lovely to meet you, Erin. Those eyes holding mine, taking me in. I take his hand in mine, making sure to match his grip. I feel the whole of his warm hand wrapped around my fingers, which are still cool from the washroom. I let him have a smile. I let it spread across the corners of my lips and up to my eyes. I give him some of myself. And you, I reply. I need to know who he belongs to, if I could have him. Could I have him? Can I get anyone a drink? I offer. Actually, hon, I was just going to nip to the loo's. Toilet relay. Back in a minute. Caro trills and exits, leaving only a waft of rich perfume behind. She's left him here for me. But then I guess hot guys are 10 a penny to the Caros of this world. Mark loosens his tie slightly with his forefinger and thumb. Dark navy suit. Fuck. Drink, Mark? I offer. Oh, God, no, sorry, let me. Champagne is ordered with a nod and a wave. He gestures over to a nook and we sit down together at a low table. It turns out he's only just met Caro and he's here alone. Well, he came with a friend named Richard, who is talking to that lovely lady over there. Mark points to a woman who is very clearly an escort. Latex knee-length boots and bored wandering eyes. Richard doesn't seem to be too bothered by the lack of conversational input and appears to have the talking covered for both of them. Wow, okay. Interesting. I was not expecting that. Wow. Mark grins and nods, and I completely fail to intercept my full-on snort of laughter. He laughs too. We're very close, Richard and I, he intones with mock solemnity. He's over for the day from a Swiss bank. I'm basically his minder or carer. Who knows? I just have to take him where